Power District Number 5, board meeting in the Overton office, March 20th at 3 p.m. Is there any public comment? Do I hear a motion for acceptance of the agenda?
So moved.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the agenda. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, item D, approval of the minutes of the previous meeting held February 21st, 2024.
I move we approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the meetings of the previous meeting from February 21st. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Probably want another one.
Okay. Chair's report, I don't have much to report. We received a card here sending all of our love for 2024 from the Yurts, Trey, Carrie, Toby, Tyler, and TJ to the Board of Trustees. Thought it might have just been to OPD. So that is here if anybody would like to look at it.
He gets my vote.
Yeah. He's not opposed, he's in the chair. But that's a good thing, okay. And this is just something I thought for each of the board members to look at. It's just kind of an interesting article, worth sharing with all of you. Pros and cons about solar and different kinds of solutions. So when you're in your free time, because you all have so much free time, if you want to look at it, that would be great. And that's it on my report, attorney report.
I've got nothing to report at this time. I will be involved in the discussion of the mutual aid agreement that I've reviewed.
Okay. Manager's reports.
Okay, Scott, would you like to lead off?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, this is one of my more exciting reports. It's the Administrative Services. Okay, let's start out with IT, cybersecurity training. We're at 98% for the month of February. Internal phishing results, we had a really bad January. We got 3 people to click. I will say that we have new employees in the company, and that's who we are seeing that is clicking on these emails. So they are receiving extra training for that. No clicks in the month of February. 1,626 spam for the month of February. 2,049 for January. Here's a slide for firewall blocks by country. I know that I print 2 of these reports out. I don't know who uses those, who they go to, but you have this in your report. 100% server system uptime. Data backup restore was 100% for the month of February. And then we're going to roll right into customer service. New automatic bill pay, bank and credit card draft. We have 40 new signups and 56 new signups for the month of January. So a little bit slower start, but we're going to work on that. That gives us a total of 9,648 or 52.87% of our customer base are using automatic bill pay. We would love to see that at 80%. So that's kind of where we want to be.
It's moving in the right direction.
It's moving in the right direction, yes. This time last year, we were at 50%, so we're 52.87%, making progress.
Always forward.
That's right. It's not going the other way. New customers on e-bill, a little bit slower, 15 in January, 25 in February, for a total of 5,022, or 27.52%. Last year at this time, we had 25.48%. So, the right direction, just slower than we want to see it. All right, total number of calls. We're seeing the same end of year trend continue. We're still much lower than we were at the beginning of last year, 1,319 for February. Our average on hold wait time, 8 seconds. I don't think you can really beat that by much. It's what we were doing all throughout the second half of last year. And then the average talk time we're seeing has gone up. We have new customer service reps that are spending more time with the customers. So that is up a little bit past the 2.5 minute mark. Total walk-in customers for January was 2054, for February was 1912. And now let's move into the my favorite part of this whole presentation, because we're just making huge progress. X followers and profile visits. Who here uses X? Twitter.
I'm one of your
just followers. Like three or four of us. That's crazy.
that's how you get the number.
We have 352 total followers. Nobody visited our profile last month, which is okay. But, I mean, that's okay. We did have 114 impressions, so our post showed up, and 114 different people saw that post, and we did 5 Twitter postings in the month of February. Let's move to Instagram. New Instagram followers, we have 8 for the year so far. Which gives us a total of 481, and we reached 201 Instagram followers in the month of February.
Logged on, yeah.
That is the right direction. Slower than we want to see. Facebook is the big one. So number of Facebook posts. And we had a communications meeting this morning. You're going to see that our posts are going to be similar among all the platforms from here on out. We did 13 in February. I believe there was an outage. So more postings. New Facebook followers, we're at 20 for the year, 12 in January, 8 in February. And our Facebook reach, because of that outage, 6,446 in the month of February. Anyone who saw our post in their feed. And that gives us a total of 4,132 in Facebook followers. So, slow and steady. And that is my presentation. So, any questions?
I would like to see in public relations type things. It's nice to have that many posts. It'd be better if it wasn't for outages, which is nothing we have a choice over.
And they weren't all outage posts. There's other posts that we're doing, but yeah, absolutely.
I think we need to try and find something to interest people where they might post on that without...
Try to get the engagement without it being an outage.
Yeah, exactly.
Instagram had an interesting one that said, this is a test.
That was today.
Today.
I saw that.
You saw it? So you saw it on Instagram? Who else saw that post?
Twitter. Well, I don't know if I passed or not.
We're working on it.
One of the things that we had talked about some time ago is preparing press releases for the press. Every couple of months, do we produce something like that?
Press releases as needed. I don't know that we do it every few months. I know that we're going to be doing quite a few coming up because of what we have going on as far as rates.
Yeah.
But not press releases, just to make a press release. I know we do have things that we do need to work on in that regard.
Yeah. So, well, especially if we have a rate increase.
Yes, yes.
Now let's get something positive out there.
Yeah.
Is there a way that we can make it easier for people to either e-bill or become, pay automatic, and even in the paper or something, have the QR code that they can just scan with their phone and do it that way? I mean, have you already tried all that?
I don't know that there's an easier way. I mean, I think our key is when they come into the office that our customer service reps are engaging with them and telling them about the services. And I know that we do that every time we have a customer come in.
Okay.
And we'll waive their $25 connect fee if they sign up for ACH.
For New Connect.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
You know, one of the agencies I went into actually handed me a handbill that had the email, the addresses. It seemed to me, I walked in and had them tell me what it was, but of course I walk out the door and I don't remember what the heck it is.
Yeah.
But you might want to do almost like a business card.
Like a little card with the QR code where they can...
Yeah, that's right, where they can get it. So that might help a little bit.
Okay.
And it's not very expensive and easy to do. And
yeah. Okay, appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Scott.
Yep.
Randall is at MIP for 2 weeks, so his faithful associate Brett is going to give our engineering report today.
Okay. So the RG2... RG number 2 project, Reed Gardner Switchyard from Tortoise Substation, is underway. Summit Line Construction's the contractor. And that this project should be complete in May. So in a couple months, this whole line should be built.
Well, now, the whole project, or the first phase of the project, two phases, right?
This is the line that goes from Reed Gardner to Tortoise. That's only 2 miles.
Okay, it's not the Tortoise substation.
No, so they'll get the line done, but we have to do the cutover, which we're going to have to wait till the fall to do that.
Why is that?
Because we can't carry our load on our existing lines unless the loads are down, and that happens in the fall and in the spring.
Yeah.
And I saw there was paid to Nevada Power $377,000 to raise the structure. Was that part of this project?
Raise the poles?
So.
Yeah, there was one.
Yeah, we had to raise some poles, but I didn't think that came through us.
Okay. We had a bill from Nevada Energy for. It didn't say how many poles, but it said raising poles are about 300.
Yeah, they needed to raise the lines coming into the Tortoise substation.
Oh, the existing lines?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're going underneath them, not up. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so Raptor substation. Savonic has completed all the dirt work there. Cocopelli is finishing up the block wall. It's probably complete by now. And after that, Cocopelli will be heading over to the long drive switch yard to start the retaining wall and block wall over there. We received the bids back for the steel for Raptor substation, and we're just under review and engineering right now. The Gila 138 line, Tortoise substation to Gila substation, we built portions of the line roads out there for AGEC to come out and do soils testing. The drill rig should be out first end of March, first week of April, so that we can get that underway.
Have you already chosen the contractor for that?
Not yet.
No.
You're just getting the.
Just we're still working on the data, right?
Yes.
Engineering.
So that kind of concludes my presentation. The shoe fly is going to be starting here very shortly. Shoe fly around the long drive switch yard. It's just a temporary construction of the line so that they can get in there and construct the switch yard safely. So, any questions?
Okay, thank you, Brett. Good job. Okay, Corey, let's pass that down to you. Thank you.
So hookups for the month of February, we had a great month. We had 56 residential hookups and 4 commercial hookups for a total of 60 for the month of February. So annual puts us at 108 so far this year. And then we had for our locates 254 and inspections 125, and then system audit 644. And then our outages, we had 17 outages for maintenance. And that was planned outages. And then 3 unplanned outages in February. Total of 20. And those outages affected 427 customers for 374 customer hours. Leave this in with our AC at 99.997. Our safety program, 6 years, 5 months, and 7 days with no lost time accident.
Yay.
Good.
And February's safety topic was CPR AED training.
What is AED?
Automated
electric.
Yes.
Did somebody volunteer?
I tried to get rich.
They have training pads that you use.
They have little funny people that shoot. Careful, you're a funny person. You might be next. Does everybody get that training, or just your staff?
No, everybody gets it.
Everybody in. Fabulous.
That's great. Yeah.
Yep. So we do it annually.
Very good.
Yep. It's required. OSHA for the outside is required every 2 years, but we do it. Okay. So our training yard right out here. We've been. Every month during right after safety meeting, we try and utilize that and expand the knowledge and ability of our line personnel, particularly. And in this instance, it was some scenarios that hats off to Kyle, kind of headed that up and his lead men there and did scenario based of maybe some incidences that we've had in the past that took us a little bit of time to figure out, or some other instances that we've had, and so kind of bring those back into the rotation so that we can work on those, so that if we have that event again, we're well tuned up in that. And so this was two different projects. We had our apprentices that were working through those projects to be able to recognize and understand maybe some of the challenges that are out there. So this is our breaker change out, 69 kV breaker change out in Tortoise. You see in this picture on the right hand side, the 69 is actually de-energized, but because of clearance issues, we had to do hot sticks to be able to pull the jumpers off to be able to get in there and do the work necessary. Some cool projects. So this one might recognize that this is one of the outages we just had recently, and it took two phases down on Jones Street, took out to downtown Overton. And so the tree actually broke right here at the base and came down and took. There was quite a bit of a distance from the line, but it was still, because it was above the line, took that out.
It almost looks like the line goes through the next group of trees. You know, the short...
Down here?
Yeah, the short one, I'm looking at the right picture on the right, and it almost looks like the line's going through there.
Down here?
No, back...
Right there.
Right?
Well, right up here.
Below it.
The line that's down is down.
Oh yeah, that's this line has come down. That's
no,
the tree's
down.
Caught it. Yeah, okay. The tree's caught it and brought
okay,
it.
But usually it's up where the other line is.
Correct.
Way high.
Correct.
Okay. Fine. Yep.
This was a project. It was actually a weekend project that was done in Mesquite on the Boulevard. We needed to take John Diesel out, as well as the businesses across the street. And this was a pole change with some services, and also fed into the trailer park. And so that was a good project right along the boulevard that the crew got done.
Got done on the weekend just so the businesses would have power while they were working?
Correct. Yeah. This was on Mesquite Boulevard, by the West Mesquite Boulevard, by the Valley Inn Motel. Right between the theater and the motel. It had air switch on the pole. It was a good pole to get changed out. It actually, we had the pole stubs, the metal pole stubs that were on it that we had secured this. The pole was rotten, and got around on our maintenance to getting that pole changed out. And so this is what the new pole looks like and the finished product there on the right hand side. So that's my report, unless you have any questions for me.
I have one little one.
Okay.
The line locates inspections for February, locates inspections, audit. Do you have like a crew that does that, or is it just somebody gets that?
So line locates and inspections, that is split to inspections to a degree between engineering and line ops. But we have a guy here in Mesquite that has been doing a lot of those, Ben. Has been picking up the locates over here, as well as inspections, and he's been doing the majority of the audits.
Okay, so you basically have a person dedicated to
and
that.
And then in Mesquite, we have someone that does our, Chris okay. Felix is our locator.
Okay. I just, I noticed that the numbers seem to be up a little bit. So,
on the system audit, that has been a change that we've made in the last several months. Because just in getting someone specifically doing system audits. Yeah.
Very good.
Because we hadn't been getting the numbers that we needed.
Very good.
Okay, thank you, Corey. Kevin?
Colorful.
Bright lights.
So some of the projects we've been working on, this one was in conjunction with the line crew, is we've got an old OCR, which is an oil circuit recloser, is OCR. Last year we budgeted to change two of these out in the substations, and we're replacing them with these new vacuum bottle reclosers. A lot quicker, a lot safer, a lot nicer recloser. These OCRs require a lot of maintenance, a lot of upkeep, and they're getting to the point where now they're seeing their life expectancy. So I've been trying to change them out. Our insurance company likes these a lot better. These ones, they ask me each year if you've been doing your maintenance on them. Kind of. So anyway, that's what they've been working on. Another project they're working on, and they're actually doing this today, is this is out in Bunkerville. They saw on one of these bushings, the oil was a little bit darker color than the other two. And so that got them thinking we probably ought to test this transformer and see if there's something going on with it. And so what they'll do is they'll get up, they'll de-energize, the whole substation has to be de-energized. So all that power's got to be rerouted to another substation. They disconnect all the connections off the top, connect a whole bunch of wires that go to a box, a piece of testing equipment, and they'll run it through a whole bank of tests. And then when they're done, hopefully they give a thumbs up that it's okay. If not, we have to spend more money, replace a bushing or something. That's kind of a double-edged sword. You want to make sure everything's right, but once you find out that it's not, you know, you got to spend a lot more money. There's a lot of rust and stuff up there. They'll take care of a lot of maintenance and stuff. And that's a project. I haven't heard yet whether this one is good or not. They have, like I said, they were doing this one today. So, another project they were doing. Some stuff that I've been doing is I've been working with some companies on some ideas on how to increase our security at our more critical substations. We've got some really good feedback from some suppliers, and I've gotten pricing on a lot of it. It's not cheap by any means, but some of the stuff they're coming up with is the systems they use have been used to protect the military in combat. They'll actually see a perimeter, and you can see through smoke, dust, fog, whatever, it'll see it, and the cameras will pick up that motion and follow them around. They've got that technology so we can actually see if someone's walking around the perimeter of the fence. You can see the car pull up, and this will actually come and it'll give us triggers to say, hey, somebody's at your substation. And we can watch them as they walk around, and the cameras will follow them. And then if they get inside, it'll set off another alarm saying they've gone into the substation. So a little early detection. And then we've been looking at a few different types of fences. So anyway, been working on that and trying to get ballistic pricing on ballistic shields around the substation transformers too. So just a few things I've been working on.
Can you talk to them back? A lot of security systems have a situation you're under observation or something like that.
There's that option too. We can get microphones and speakers and stuff.
Yeah.
And we can actually talk to them and say, hey.
Sometimes even a recorded message.
Yeah.
But, you know, when people know
something
they're
that says, aim, fire.
Well, I hope not.
pull back.
I might just leave at least. I would leave.
Any questions for me? Okay.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
Oh, tremendous.
Judy, I need you to come right over here. Christy, if you'll come up here, you come with me too.
Oh, it's going to be a problem.
Oh, yeah, positive.
Judy has earned her Director Gold certificate.
Woo-hoo!
Oh, man.
Oh, I just love taking classes.
Come right here in the middle of this, Judy.
Okay, I don't want to come between you two. Could you scoot in a little so yes. You guys look back to that one? Thanks. Not too much. Thank you.
I don't have to do much to look like that one, so here you go.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, just a couple of things to report. First of all, we had our NREA board meeting in Las Vegas last month. We had good attendance, and we also have explored a new location to have our annual meeting there this year. So we went and tested it out, and things worked pretty well, so we can look forward to going to the Aliante in October for our NREA annual meeting. I worked with Scott and Kelly and Christy. We completed hiring interviews for Mesquite Customer Service, and we had a new person that started there Monday, right? And so we appreciate her taking the job. I attended the NRECA Power Exchange. Just wanted to give you a brief report that I thought the speakers were really good. I enjoyed the speakers. A lot of focus on technology and AI. I was able to attend a couple of breakout sessions with Mr. Rust and Mr. Young on grassroots legislative efforts, which was interesting. And then I attended a couple of sessions with Mr. Jones on an economic update and supply chain issues. And both of those were really interesting as well. I was able to meet with most of our vendors and many of the local leaders around us. So we had a good meeting. I just wanted to also let you know that last month I reported that we are working on a joint action agency for Nevada where we can perhaps create generation and transmission resources between the various utilities. I have had a follow-up meeting with the two other groups that are participating with me in doing this. That's the Colorado River Commission and Valley Electric Association. Gail Bates at the Colorado River Commission has found an opportunity for a startup grant that we're going to apply for, and she's doing the work to apply for that so that we can hopefully in sometime in the next 18 months start an organization together. And that's my report, unless you have any questions for me.
I'm glad you're looking at it.
Well, hopefully we can find something. You know, we're... In some instances, the utilities are fairly close, and I say fairly close, within 100 miles. So there's a lot of work to do, but if we don't start somewhere, it'll never happen. So we're hoping that we can get some links together where we can do some joint projects.
Well, I think, aren't the grants for transmission and generation transmission are more readily available than a power district that is already operating and like us, we're buying power.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
I think that's really smart. Thank you.
And did you want to talk about power purchase contract, how that's going? Do you have another time?
We will talk about that later tonight. I'll give you an update on that.
Okay.
So thank you.
You know, this, I was just going to ask, are you looking at a particular type of generation? Or would you
so... The Colorado River Commission is very interested being in Las Vegas in a solar project, but all of the NREA members are interested in some type of natural gas generation. And so the first project that we do once we form the organization will likely depend on who the first off-takers are. So for example, Valley and Boulder City are looking more for solar, whereas the rest of us already have solar and we're looking for more firm resources.
It looked like Mark Stallions was down at San Antonio.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you get a chance to visit with him there?
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah, we got a chance to visit there.
Not much talk about the nuclear, I take it. I know I heard that nuclear project in Idaho, was it, that got canceled?
So there's still a lot of talk about nuclear, but beyond the talk, it's hard to get permitting through, and that's the problem.
Yeah. Luckily, we can get it for our submarines and aircraft carriers.
Yeah, and why we can't take a modular unit like that and plug it in somewhere is
hard to understand. They generate electricity, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. For years.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, Melissa, we'll turn the time to you for your report.
Our operating revenue for the month of February was $3,911,000. Our cost of purchase power on line number 3 was $1,782,000. That contributed to our total cost of electric service on line number 20 of $3,067,000. If you look on line number 22, it's not highlighted, I apologize. That was the interest that we received for the month is $126,000. Uh-huh, for our month. For the year so far, we are at $261,000. That gave us a margin for the month of $970,000, and for the year, we're at $1.7 million. On the asset side of our balance sheet, we have a net utility plant value of $120 million. We have cash, temporary investments, materials, and other deferred credits giving us a total asset value of $175,954,000. If you look on the liability side of our balance sheet, you can see that our total margins and equities on line number 36 is now valued at $117 million. We have long-term debt, accounts payable, and other deferred credits giving us, again, that total liability value of $175 million. Here is a breakdown of our cash balances. At the top, you can see our bank balance. We had a decrease from last month of $999,000 just in those checking accounts. Our Morton asset balance is at $34,420,000, and our Goldman Sachs is at $2,568,000. Jonathan and I met with Morton and did a review of our portfolio this last month. Randall and I have updated the cash needs for 2024 and 2025. And so we have currently, at the end of this month, $2.5 million in investments with Morton that are going to be maturing. At that time, we are going to move those into our checking account as we have bills coming up in preparation for some of those projects. Morton had, during our review, told us that they had $26 million of our investments that they were able to reprice at the average rate of 5.2%. Now, in this quarter, yes. So a couple of things that I think that it's important for us to talk about when we talk about these investments is that our money, we have stuck with insured and government-backed funds. We always purchase below FDIC insurance, and we continue to ensure that we have good protection and diversity across our portfolio. Now, one of the things that we talked about last month was, wouldn't it be better if we dumped more money into Goldman because it's at 5.2 as opposed to Morton, which was at, the average was at 4. There's a couple of reasons that we don't do that. Part of that is that diversification. But as you see that the way that the rates are rising right now, they were able to put $26 million at the average of 5.2 with longevity. So we didn't move all of the money out into too far, but we do, you'll see when we look over the duration, we've moved some of that into longer term so that we ensure we have the longevity of that rate. One of the great things about Goldman is that their rate has paid so well, and it's right now at 5.239, but they're also very reactionary. As the rate goes down, then it immediately, as rates are cut, so does Goldman. So any money that we have in there is received at that lower rate. But if we can lock it with Morton, we're now getting that same rate for a longer-term investment. So Morton has done a wonderful job of investing that. After that, those rate rewrites, we ran a cash flow analysis with them, and they anticipate for 2024 a $1.6 million return on our investments for the year.
I have a question on the slide. The little tiny number on the right-hand side lower...
Is the investment, it is the interest we've received for each one for just that year.
Yeah. First, could you make it a little bigger so I can see it?
Yes, sir.
And maybe we want to label it somehow, like a plus in front of it or something?
Yes.
That's the good news.
Yes.
It really is. I mean, it's terrific news.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, $200,000.
Yeah, I'll make that a little jazzier for you.
Thank you.
Perfect. This is broke down by, this is the breakdown of those investments for Morton by security type. And again, this is the duration. If you remember last month, we had about $15 million in that short term. And you remember also, though, that on all of those corporate bonds that rewrite on cost, they stay in that shorter duration period because as the rates increase, we get the new rate. So it's reported that way. We do not have it all in such a short turnaround. This is just a breakdown of the average interest rate. I know it's hard to see on the screen, but I like to put it up there for you guys for your review before the meeting because it shows you the average and that we see a lot of those initial investments that we made with Morton back in 2021 have all fallen off and we've been able to rewrite those. And so we're getting a good return there.
Could you make the average a little bit bigger? So
yes.
Again, good news.
Yes.
Since the papers are hard.
At the end of the month, we finished with 18,349 customers. We will have a modified debt service coverage with estimates through the end of the year at 2.43. Our equity as a percentage of assets is now at 66.64, and our TIER is currently at 7.24. We had 24 connect fees for a total of $12,854. We currently have 23 billing arrangements for residential customers for a value of $4,412. And our roundup program is going strong for both valleys for their sports programs. This is a breakdown of our long-term debt. We will have a payment due at the end of March, and that payment will be made in full and on time.
I do notice one of them is 4.9%, and it's going to be paid off in a few years. But does it do us any advantage to pay it off early?
We looked at that a few months ago, and it didn't. It did not. The fees did not.
We have to pay them the interest or something.
Yeah, it did not. It did not pencil out for us for it to be cost effective. And we're at such the end of the loan that we're right now making mostly principal payments. So, yeah, we did research that one.
Okay.
This is a breakdown of revenue by customer class. If I make this a little bit bigger, at the bottom of the page, you can see that our monthly cost of power was at 5 cents. Our monthly revenue is at 10.66 cents. So our 2024 average cost is at 5.38 cents, which, you know, if we convert that over to megawatts, that would be $53.80 per megawatt hour. And we'll discuss that later tonight. So just so you're aware of our cost right now. And that concludes my presentation, unless you guys have any more questions for me.
Oh, I did have a question. On the check register, there is a check to LADWP for Moapa Power. I thought we were supplying.
Moapa?
It says that.
Oh.
Yeah, what's the deal there?
So we have a contract with LADWP that they purchase power. They purchase through NV Energy, but they are in our service territory. So we have a billing that we pay them, and then that customer pays us, and we have administrative fees that we receive on top of that. So LADWP buys solar power in our service territory. The service that they have to have back feed power for that solar generation, it's in our service territory, so we provide that, and we pay LADWP, and then the customer pays us, plus an administrative fee. No, LADWP is selling the power. Well, they're buying the power, but we're selling the back feed. This is just the back feed for the solar install. And we've had that contract for...
It's only a couple thousand dollars.
Yeah, I've asked
5 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Item H, presentation on rates by Cooperative Finance Corporation for discussion only.
Well, we have some special guests here tonight, and I really appreciate them being here. And I'm going to turn this over to Melissa to to introduce.
So tonight I am going to introduce Jason Strong and his team from CFC. We requested that Jason and his team put together for us a revenue requirement study and a cost of service study. And I just want to say that I wanted to fall over when I received Jason's initial email of request of data. I felt like it was a truckload of information that I was going to have to provide to them. And he gave me about 3 months to get this all put together to give to him. And Merlin Wallenzine, one of our guys from IT, and myself, we spent midnight oil, just burning midnight oil, getting some of this data at the last minute for them so that they could get it all together. But Jason and his team are among the best in the nation, and we are very lucky to have his expertise. So I'm going to turn the presentation over to him, and we just want to say thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Well, it's nice to be back at Overton. I think I was kind of looking back at our records. I think we've been doing great work for you all for the better part of 20, maybe even 30 years, well before my time. I know when I joined CFC back in 2017, this was one of my first engagements and probably one of the first, board and management meetings. So it's close to home, and it's always enjoyable, working with the great management team and getting, to know some of you all over the years. I'm joined by my colleagues in back, joining me today, Omar Dalla and Nick DeSanti. They're really the brains behind the operation, delivering.
But you take your glory.
Well, it's both sides, right? Sometimes it's good news, and sometimes it's not. So we started working, on this rate study. I think it was about summer of last year, and it's quite an undertaking from, just the document data request, collecting all of the information, and then, several months for us to complete our work and, start to get feedback and kind of collaborate on, what things look like on the back side. So what I'm going to share with you all today is really kind of the overall kind of the results of our study and kind of what we're seeing. But I think also importantly, as I'm working through and sharing some of the study results, I think it's important to kind of briefly walk through methodologies and not necessarily to make you all rate experts today and this afternoon. That would take probably a couple of days, but I think that lends itself to a little bit better understanding and maybe confidence in the work itself. I'll just kind of jump in. I guess at the overall engagement, there were really kind of three pieces to this. Doing a revenue requirement study, doing a cost of service study, and evaluating rate design and implementation options should the modeling and our work identify the need for additional operating revenue. I'm going to kind of walk through each of those three steps, the revenue requirement cost study and some of the implementation options. I think part of what makes rate making awfully complex, and I don't know that it necessarily needs to be as complex as some make it out to be, is sometimes just terminology. Terms get used very loosely and maybe not well defined. So I really encourage you all, if there's questions that you have throughout, please interrupt and we'll get you squared away. When we conduct a rate study, it's really three steps. And through those steps and analyses, we're asking three key questions. And our modeling and analyses is attempting to provide answers around those three questions. A revenue requirement study is really looking at how much. It's looking to the total level of operating revenue and patronage capital that is recommended and suggested given your level of operating expenses as well as your considerations for margins and some of the financial goals and objectives that you all have as an electric cooperative. The cost of service study then is from who? What does it cost to serve each of the groups of members on your system, from your residential to your irrigation, so on and so forth. And that can be very instructive then in implementing certain rate designs and potentially implementing rate increases that you know in particular who you know is causing some of those costs to be incurred. And then lastly is rate design, and that's really where everything culminates and comes together. That's the how. How we collect the overall suggested operating revenue, many times taking into account cost causation drivers and ensuring that we're collecting the right amount of money from the right folks based on the type of service and the cost that they're placing on the system. So kind of stepping into that question one in the revenue requirement study, how much? This is really a twofold question. When we look at total operating revenue and operating revenue and patronage capital, there's two components to this. This really goes to line one on your Form 7, your annual Form 7. Component number one is operating expenses. Certainly as operation and maintenance expenses go up, administrative and general costs, maybe power supply costs increase or somehow change, this would be kind of the bucket number one of operating expenses and costs that would indicate that additional money may be needed through the collection of rates. On the right-hand side of the equation, then, is the other component in consideration. And this is margins. This is your operating income and margins to fulfill financial goals. And within the cooperative network, those financial goals are typically maintaining equity in cooperative itself, as well as investing back into the system through your construction work plan and paying for those reliability projects, at least in part through the equity that is in place. So when we look at conducting a revenue requirement study, it's looking at operating expenses for a particular period and looking to see if there is changes in the expenses, but then also taking a look at the level of margins that are needed to meet those particular goals that you might have. Margins can be, determining a level of margins that are needed, I think is really the trickiest part of the analysis overall. We know what the operating expenses are, oftentimes from a Form 7 and a budget. We can see those bills coming in and they get recorded. The level of margins is a little tougher, determining how much is needed to maintain equity and to reinvest back in the system. It's a little bit bigger, question mark. Within the cooperative network, there's really, three different methodologies that can be utilized. And oftentimes in our work, we are looking at, maybe not just one in particular, but utilizing all three methods to, look at the full scope and full picture of what might be needed. One of the methods that's utilized and that we certainly take into account is your financial ratios. MDSC, the level of MDSC that's needed to not only meet debt service.
Sorry, what was the acronym?
MDSC, your modified debt service covenant.
Okay.
And so, borrowing money from CFC, for instance, there's a minimum threshold level that's an MDSC that's needed to meet those requirements. Oftentimes we might take a look at something like a cash flow analysis. If you know where the money is being spent across various operating activities, you can kind of determine bottom line level of margins that's needed to meet each of those activities and needs. The rate of return model is one that the cooperative network has used now for the better part of 35, 40 years. And this is really our starting place, but then taking into account these other aspects. The rate of return method is very akin to what an investor-owned utility might use. It's the return that is earned, essentially profit. But the model that we use is designed specifically for the cooperative network, kind of that, three-legged stool. It's it's equity and construction work plan and reinvesting back into the system. And so looking at in particular at equity and your growth in plant or rate base, the facilities that are in place ultimately to provide service to your members and what that growth year after year looks like. Taking a look at those two key inputs allows us to determine through the modeling a suggested level of return that ultimately gives us a level of margins that you would add to the overall operating expenses. Rate base is a very important part of a revenue requirement study. It is, providing services on, you need poles and wires and line transformers. It's looking at the return on member investment in those, in the plant, in order to provide that resilient and reliable power. Rate base is essentially, for all intents and purposes, the amount of plant that's in place out on your distribution system. So kind of getting into, this is a 30,000 foot vantage point, we'll get into a little bit more detail, but a revenue requirement study has a starting place. Typically that is a 12 calendar months, a year end. Our starting place here was using 2022 calendar year end as of December 31st. But given that that was a year and a half ago, you certainly want to make adjustments to that to be as forward-looking yet as realistic as possible to take into account some additional circumstances that occurred in 2023 and into potentially 2024. And so the 2022 actual, these are figures and levels of returns and financial ratios that would kind of be dictated by what was ultimately ended up on the Form 7. But taking into account certain adjustments, we utilized financials through the end of October of 2023 and then annualized those for the remaining 2 months. Also taking into account, knowing that there are ongoing discussions and negotiations with the cost of power supply, and taking into account some indications of what that cost change might be, as well as your 2023 construction work plan. So it's forward looking and yet realistic. Not a forecast looking out several years, but really, core to the last couple of years.
I notice on the charts, the lower portion, which has our operating tier, MDSC, and the others, dropped dramatically.
Correct.
Is that just because we borrowed money?
No, and actually quite...
Quite
the opposite. In 2022, remind me, I guess when was the last rate increase here at Overton? Yeah. It's been quite some time. What we've experienced over the last several years, kind of coming out of COVID, is inflation and supply chain issues. Costs are going up almost from every component, from salaries and equipment and components of plant. And so when we look at 2022, actual, that was a snapshot, and from there, costs have been going up in particular.
So it's almost totally responsible for inflation, really costs.
Inflation, and as I'll point out, really one of the sole drivers of the adjustments and what I'll be kind of sharing with you all here this evening is the cost of purchase power going up. That cost per megawatt hour, that's for Morgan Stanley, that's that will be changing here in short order. So there's been from 2022, and as we've adjusted, there's been kind of a natural degradation of ratios and returns, and you add to that inflation and then supply chain issues and cost pressure, and then additional power supply costs, and of course those ratios will decline, and those returns and levels of margins will decline. So ultimately then, after we've adjusted the financials and taken into account your construction work plan, our 2022-2023, what we call ROR, or rate of return model, kind of indicates the level of operating revenue and level of margins that would be suggested given your operating expenses and margin needs. Our modeling was indicating, suggested return on rate base, if we kind of think back to that formula that we take operating expenses and we add to that the level of plant or rate base times the return, given your unique circumstances, the model's indicating a need for a 5.14% return on rate base. And ultimately, bringing the level of margins up from kind of the historic adjusted 2.8 million in operating margins to a suggested level of 5.5 million. Certainly, lower and different from historic years, let up some of this adjusted. So, kind of getting to the punchline. One of the key and really, kind of sole drivers of cost pressures are cost of purchase power. And so working with the management team here and, over the last many months, looking at, what the cost of purchase power was through Morgan Stanley back in 2022, and using, some indicative pricing that, that has been in place on what that might look like, going into later this year and next year under that new contract. You'll see that this is in all of your purchase power. There is a component of hydro that just to simplify things we're taking out and setting aside. But if we were just looking at Morgan Stanley, back in calendar year 2022, that was about $16.6 million. Taking into account some of the changes that will be occurring in the relatively near future, the cost of power for Morgan Stanley will increase to about $23.2 million.
That's about a 10% increase?
Or so, yeah. It's hard to do math on the spot, but yeah.
Close.
Yeah. But then also taking into account, the potential for solar that, might be, coming online as well. So looking at kind of the full requirements of the power supply needed to serve your members and under kind of the new cost construct, what that would look like, base case scenario, new Morgan Stanley pricing, as well as some of that coming from solar. The last kind of scenario that is, no solar. So, everything coming from hydro, which we've set aside, but then if everything were coming from solar and there weren't, the solar contract and project ongoing as well, it looks very different. Overall cost would go from $16.6 million up to $29.1 million. Yes, sir, I believe there was a...
Yeah, I was wondering, what pricing model did you use for the base scenario? Can you tell us that?
Sure, so, it's relatively simple. I know that, Nick spent quite a bit of time. There's a lot of information online, like S&P Power, as well as some of their production cost models. But even more simplistically, if you have a general idea of what that price per megawatt hour is, multiplied by a total number of sales.
I can speak to that if you want. So currently you guys, your power supplied at a rate of $44 a megawatt hour from Morgan Stanley. Under the initial contract, you had 2.1 million megawatt hours that were supplied at a rate of $50 a megawatt. Towards the end of that contract, any supply above that initial threshold is supplied at a lower rate. Right now, during 2022, natural gas prices skyrocketed significantly across the entire country. In California, 90% of your gas is imported. So 10%, or not California, California and even Nevada, a lot of that gas is imported, not produced in-state. So you're getting it from like Texas, you're getting it from some of the major hubs in Louisiana, Henry Hub being one of them. So with the initial contract, it was 5 years, now you're gonna renew at a set term, and those prices have gone up significantly since your initial contract of $44. Currently, like forward prices are showing in the SP 15 price zone, which is in California, is probably where you're getting your power from. Morgan Stanley, they could be getting it from anywhere, but that's a pretty good hub to be looking at prices. And right now, fortunately, when you renew the contract, it's actually looking pretty good. Average wholesale prices have gone down in most trade hubs across 48 states. That bandwidth and that zone was like 200, as high as $250 a megawatt hour to as low as 50. But what we did to come up with these prices or these costs were, we took your load in 2022, so the load that you guys had in 2022, a portion of that load we stripped out because we estimate that under the filing from the Nevada Public Service Commission, that solar facility, 180 megawatts, it's, you guys have contracted for 25 megawatts of that load. So they estimate, based on that 25 megawatts, how much it's going to produce in a year. And in 2025, it's roughly 66 million megawatt hours based on that 25 megawatt contract. So what we did was we took the fixed price and the final, which is $35 a megawatt hour, times it by the estimated load it could produce to come up with that $2.2 million. And for the rest of your load, you're going to be buying for more than standard. So 2022 load, subtract the solar production, 66 million megawatt hours. And that difference we're going to multiply by what we think the contract price is going to renew at, which roughly $90 is what we're looking at, based on wholesale prices in today's markets.
And that's just what I wanted to know. So that when we're looking at pricing, we know these numbers are based, what number they're based on.
So you're going to, currently right now you guys are going through a solicitation. They're going to be providing you prices. Based on my experience, those solicitations are under NDA. So you can't, we don't know what those prices are going to be. There's certain people that do, and you sign an NDA to get access to that. But once you sign for the new contract, you're going to get either a full fixed price. There's some other pricing that you could do. You could do purchasing blocks. You could do purchasing in real time. But based on your contract, you're doing fixed pricing. So we think it's going to be about $90 a megawatt hour based on current market trends.
Okay.
And fortunately, prices are going down. Like natural gas prices are going down, electric prices are going down. Apparently, from what I'm reading, improved hydroelectric conditions in California are helping these prices too. I know that's a crapshoot. It could go any year. It could go up or down. So yeah, that's what we think it's going to be.
Okay, thank you.
It's a well-judged scenario, and I guess, but still, it's been
educated.
So we feel is, you know, reasonable, just kind of given, you know, some of the information that's out there. It's something different, higher than what it's historically been. So, you know, kind of jumping to the punchline. The model is indicating that there's a suggested need for a rate increase, almost entirely and solely driven by the increased cost of purchase power.
And what about the inflation cost of, you know, workforce and other materials, everything that
seems So, you know, if we kind of look back historically here, so, you know, columns A, B, C, D, and E, and F, these are historic figures. These are, you know, the level of rate base in line one for those particular years, the return, level of operating income and margins and expenses for those years. You know, kind of historically, even given, you know, and even over the last couple of years, even given supply chain and inflation, you all were in quite a healthy financial position to, you know, weather, you know, that storm, for, you know, lack of a better way of saying things. You know, and then, you know, however, given the, you know, change in purchase power price, that is really the change and increase that is kind of propelling the, you know, the need for the rate increase. You know, in our modeling, you know, we're educated guess, you know, power costs will go up by about $8.9 million, nearly $9 million from where it was in 2022. The modeling is indicating the need for about a $2.7 million increase in over operating revenue. So that's not a one-for-one in that power costs are going up by $50.9 million, you all don't necessarily need an $8.9 million rate increase, because historically, kind of given the financial position, you know, you've been, you know, very strong and very healthy. So that position has certainly helped you all today, even given the circumstances of those operating expense increases. So overall, you know, we're suggesting, you know, through the modeling about, you know, a need for about $2.7 million in additional operating revenue. What that means from a percentage standpoint is 5.89% on total operating revenue. If we were looking at that percent only on electric sales, that is a 6.37% suggested rate increase. To kind of put this in perspective, which I think is always important and for what it's worth, since I've been at CFC going back to 2027, I've been involved in about 400 rate studies across 41 states and about a third of the cooperative network. Over, you know, those years in time, you start to see different trends. You see what's going on kind of nationally, regionally, state by state. I can tell you that over the last 2 to 3 years, and certainly coming out of COVID, nearly 100% of the cooperatives that we have worked with, and that's about 50 in a year, so just coming out of COVID, 2020, that's about 150 cooperatives, the vast majority of them, the modeling was suggested and needed a rate increase, and that was solely because of inflation and supply chain, and also a lot of power supply and G&T costs were beginning to increase because of fuel. On average, what we've been seeing, you know, kind of loosely, but on average across the cooperative network, you know, that suggested rate increase was, you know, typically somewhere between, I don't know, 6 and 8% on average.
6 to 8%.
So, you know, looking at, given such a significant increase in your power supply costs, having a on average 6% suggested rate increase is really on par with others, but certainly towards the lower end of you know, what others have put in place. You know, probably here across Nevada, but then also in some of the neighboring states as well.
Seems like the big risk, though, if the solar doesn't come on, and we have to buy a lot more at the higher rate, right?
Certainly, yes, yes.
Big difference.
Yeah, that would be a significant difference.
Okay, so what do you anticipate our bargain?
The question is to pay us if they don't bring it on.
Yes, so, you know, the model then is really power of each. And so if you look at your line one, your level of rate base, the suggested return in line two of 5.14%, you multiply those two, the level of margins or level of operating income would be $7.5 million there in line three.
Okay.
You're adding to that your level of operating expenses, and ultimately in line five would be the revenue requirement or the overall operating revenue of Patronage Capital. So kind of looking, you know, historically, you know, it's, you know, very on, you know, I would say par, if not on the lower end of, you know, where you've been historically with margins.
Yeah, we've had such healthy margins.
Correct.
Yep. You know, I think we had our rate study a couple of years ago and said, hey, you need to lower rate, but we knew this contract was coming.
Sure. Yeah.
And
right. Right.
So I think we've been preparing for this day.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
This 6.37 proposed increase. Mm-hmm. How far out will that cover us? Did you think we're good with that increase? We won't have to increase again for 2 years, 5 years. That, obviously, that will depend on our purchase contract length.
But. Sure. That's a great question. You know, a revenue requirement study is really looking at a point in time, usually 12 months here, but, you know, we're taking into account, you know, through 2023 and you know, power supply. So to say that, you know, a 6.37% increase will take care of you all for the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. This is the need, given this the information available at this time, and should expenses or margins that you all need increase or decrease, ultimately the need will decrease. So all else being equal, power supply, costs stay, relatively stable. Mm-hmm. You could withstand that, level of rates for some time. Sure. But if costs go up, that's the lever, the trigger of it.
We've just been spoiled. Haven't had a rate increase in 12 years. In fact, we've had a rate decrease.
Sure.
So we're kind of spoiled.
Right. So
yeah. I like that.
And as I I think there's always a bit of a silver lining, and that's always I think why I try to share some of the experience of what we've seen. I think most cooperatives were well positioned, but it's never easy to see or implement a 7-9% rate increase. We even worked with several cooperatives that they hadn't implemented a rate increase in 10-15 years. And they were positioned to have a need rate increase in about a 20-22% range. So I think given all of the things that you all are faced with, supply chain inflation, Morgan Stanley, you were all in a very strong and good financial position to begin with. It's not great to hear that a 6% rate increase is needed. That's certainly on the lower end of the spectrum from what I would see given everything that's been going on the last couple of years.
One of the things that our other race study showed that, and some of the classes I took in race setting indicated that our base rate should be increased. And in our case, the discussion, but around $50, we're charging $32 right now. And because we have a large number of people who live here year-round.
Right. Yep.
And so that doesn't take any account doing anything. If we do anything with that, mm-hmm. then we could reduce the actual amount. Because a dollar on that makes us about $1 million.
It does. And that's really where the cost of service study comes in. And I'll be sharing some thoughts and kind of initial scenarios and kind of a starting place.
Okay.
But if you all did implement about a 6% rate increase and collected an additional $2.7 million, what would that look like? And where would you collect that?
And of course, if we increase and our costs go way up, we could certainly increase the base charge a little bit.
Yeah, and here, kind of jumping ahead just a little bit, what's become more and more important and critical in rate design implementing rate increases is really ensuring that the components of the rates that you're increasing, whether it's at base or customer charge or your energy charge or demand charge, that it is strongly and highly linked with how costs are being incurred.
Yeah.
So as we'll see in the various scenarios we're going to share, power supply costs is really the sole and only driver for the suggested rate increase, and it would make sense based on cost causation to leave the base customer charge where it is, because that's not volumetric, and you'd add it to the energy, because the power supply cost is what's driving.
In a way that covers the company a little bit politically, but the fact of the matter is that last study showed it was somewhere around $50, and we're charging $32.
Sure.
And so,
a lot of these figures are, I would say, a perfect world, okay?
Sure.
And I'll point a few of those out as as I get into this part of it. If you look at the true cost and what that unit cost is and what that base charge in a perfect world could be, there's so many other considerations that you take into account with rate making and rate design with. Should it be at 50 or should it be something different? And a lot of it is kind of optics and politics
that's
and
acceptability. Yeah, that's what we had to get through and negotiate on.
So before kind of changing gears and moving into the next couple of parts, revenue requirement wise, or the suggested rate increase, are there any questions, comments, anything that I've left out or
anything,
anything important? So I don't think it's all bad news. The rate increase is never a great thing, but it could be something very, very different and much, much higher. Had things not been well managed kind of historically from an expenses and margins perspective.
Melissa, what is the term we're looking at with Morgan Stanley on the new contract? Is it 3 years?
We'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
We'll give you some options.
So the cost of service study, this is this is really important and critical. Kind of later on, as I share with you all several different scenarios of how you would implement a rate increase. The cost of service study kind of indicates cost to serve different groups of members and where some of those cost drivers are on the system. If we think about providing service to your member owners, there's really four fundamental cost drivers, cost causation principles in providing that service. In conducting a cost of service study, it's identifying each of these four buckets of costs across your various rate classes and for the total system. Your members are incurring costs, number one, simply by being a member, being a customer, and being connected to your distribution system.
Our base service charge.
Base service charge, without necessarily taking any service, pulling any electrons off the line. It's the cost of connectivity. The poles and wires that are in place simply for that that connection. Buckets two and three then are on the capacity and demand side. So, we look at the capacity and demand of your distribution system. Part of your system's in place for connectivity. The other portion of your distribution system is in place for hot summer days, cold winter nights, peak loading requirements. Given the power needs of each of your member owners, what their contribution to that is. There's also demand capacity from, the purchase power side. It's having the generating units there. It's really the steel and concrete, the size of the generating units in order to provide that power during peak loading. And then the fourth bucket being energy. That's the only truly variable cost on the system. That's the fuel and variable O&M for the generating units. It goes up and down depending on how much power is being put out onto the transmission lines and into the distribution systems. So when we conduct a cost study, we're looking at these four buckets of costs and identifying the components of plant and associated operating expenses that fall into one of these four buckets and identify the various cost causation factors in the study. Not going too far into the weeds on the cost study itself, but kind of the overall study process. Number one, we're designing the study. How do we want to group the members? You can do it high level or very granular, Form 7 or in much more detail. Kind of the best practice is to do it by rate schedule. The way that your members are billed, we would group those members together, and that's a nice apples-to-apples comparison between build revenue and the cost to serve that particular group. We functionalize the various components of plant and operating expenses, all of the poles and wires, generation, transmission, distribution into one of those four functions. We would then classify the plant and associated operating expenses. Are the costs being driven by that base charge, the cost of connectivity? Is it related to distribution demand capacity, the size of the distribution system? Is it related to power supply, either from a demand capacity or energy perspective? And then lastly, we would allocate all of those costs to the various rate class or group members in the study. This is where I think, the cost of service study and kind of turning to rate design implementation really gets interesting. On the left-hand side are all of your cost categories, cost drivers on a system. Four buckets. Your fixed base or customer connectivity costs, your distribution capacity demand related, your power supply capacity demand, and lastly, your variable energy, fuel, and O&M expense. If we were to take, in a perfect world, and on paper, take those four cost causation buckets and create kind of a theoretical, typical residential bill, you would have a four-part rate. A base charge, a demand charge for distribution, a demand charge for power supply, and a energy charge for the variable part of fuel and variable O&M. The reality, though, in designing bills oftentimes is that we don't have four line items on the bill for a variety of reasons. So oftentimes we're trying to collect four buckets of costs through a two-part rate, a base charge and an energy charge, and kind of historically collecting a good proportion of fixed costs of the distribution system and power supply capacity in a volumetric way, which, you know, does leave some utilities and cooperatives, you know, in a position that as sales steady decline, sometimes come off when you're relying on that big share of collected fixed costs, that can be problematic. This has been a real emphasis in the cooperative network over the last decade because of that volumetric risk. It is better aligning cost causation with rate collection and revenue collection, raising that monthly base or customer charge, and maybe lowering that energy charge. There's a lot of art and philosophy that goes into this. You know, most cost of service studies for a cooperative will indicate that probably have somewhere between $50 and maybe $100 in base or customer charges per, you know, residential member a month. Where, you know, still kind of in reality, you know, most customer charges are somewhere in that, you know, $25, probably $45 range per month. Where the customer charge gets, I think, kind of tricky is that it's not always popular to raise it. You know, there's a lot of education and kind of explaining of what is in that charge and why it continues to go up. But the other thing that we are also kind of learning is that, you know, probably in my career, I don't know that most cooperatives will ever get to their true cost to serve customer charge because it's kind of a multi-year, multi-phased in, and probably every year that level of customer charge continues to go up to some extent.
Sure.
So we're kind of chasing our tails in some way, but it's also kind of a cautionary tale in that, you know, that revenue is really tied to the number of meters or number of members that you have. So raising that base charge by $5 yields, you know, more money than if, you know, in subsequent years you're raising it by 50 cents or a dollar. Sometimes, you know, some utilities, you know, you kind of see it's increasing at a decreasing rate, meaning that you need a significant number of units or members to yield revenue to ultimately get to the end result. That oftentimes kind of the optics, you know, in education isn't always worth getting to a particular level. Within the cooperative network, there's kind of a glass ceiling right now at about $50 for a customer charge. And these are for, you know, probably a little bit more remote systems that have approached that. But, you know, many are sitting at $49 or $49.50. It's kind of like the infomercials at $19.99. It's a great product and a great price, right? You move that up to $20 and phone stop ringing and sales decline. So there's a balancing of the revenue that will be yielded versus, you know, the actual implementation of that. So let's kind of turn to the implementation recommendation. So modeling was indicating about 6% suggested rate increase. $2.75 million in additional operating revenue. We looked at a couple of different scenarios. Scenario one would apply the rate increase solely to the volumetric energy rate for all classes, with an increase to the existing energy charge, and that would increase it by 0.0068 cents per kWh. The reason that, you know, we applied here in scenario one, 100% of that $2.75 million to the energy charge is because, from a cost causation, cost study perspective, it's being driven solely by the increased cost of the purchase power. There would be a misalignment of how the cost was incurred and collecting that if you were putting that that cost in a different rate line item or component on member bill. Scenario two then looks at things a little differently. So one of the things that we did, and you know, you can run 100 different scenarios. You know, we kind of start with a couple of bookends, and then we start to get some feedback on what works and what doesn't work. So this was kind of our take on how, you know, things might be implemented. Scenario two, if we were looking at residential, currently right now you have tiered energy rates. You could, under this scenario, remove those tiered energy rates and have one flat energy rate and increase that residential rate upward to about 9 cents for the small general service, moving that up slightly as well. For the remaining rate classes, that would be an increase of 0.0032 cents per kWh. One of the things that some cooperatives have looked at is, you know, historically we've had inclining and declining block energy rates. Many cooperatives, for different reasons, are moving away from those and moving more towards a flat energy rate, a little simpler to understand. But also, some of these tiered energy rates were put into place for different reasons historically. You know, if you have a declining block rate where the price gets cheaper the more you use, the incentive was to use more power and purchase more. It was to drive sales, and the inclining block rate just the opposite. So there's other, rate designs and tools that we have available to us today, but there is quite a trend moving away from those and moving towards a flat rate that isn't necessarily driving upward or downward kWh energy sales. The last slide here, and I'll just kind of point this out, this will be made available to you if it isn't already. Just a little bit more detail and granularity on options that we initially set out to take a look at. On the left-hand side would be each of your rate or customer classes. The charges would be, indicating what that charge is, monthly, base, energy, or demand, and where the current rates are then today. Scenario one and scenario two, identifies what that increase and change would be. Under scenario one, again, simply taking what was in place and increasing everything across the board by 0.0068. In scenario two, essentially eliminating the tiered block rates, moving to a flat, and then applying the remaining to the other rate classes that are there. And then here showing the overall and relative impact, ultimately on the bottom, the grand total, collecting an additional $2.7 million in revenue and implementing a 6.37% rate increase on electric-only revenue. And that's an important kind of characteristic that I don't want to misunderstood. If we were, the rate increase that would be needed if we were looking at line one of your Form 7 total operating revenue, it's 5.89%. But if you took miscellaneous revenues out and we're looking at only base or, core electric revenue, that would be in 6.37%.
I noticed in scenario two, there's a wide variance in the increase at various classes here.
sometimes it's pretty hard to sell, and it seems to be putting it all on residential, almost all the increase.
Yeah, you know, if we look at, and I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but, you know, if we look at, you know, kind of the primary proportion of your system, do you know off the top of your head the percentage or, you know, ballpark, but, you know, there's a lot of residential here. You know, I don't remember, it's 40%, 50%, 60%, 70%, but, you know, the core of the sales and costs and system that are in place are really
for residential. For 2022, residential is over 50% of revenues. And the reason why it's a higher increase is because when we consolidated those tiered rate schedules, we were trying to figure out how to do it. So we just used a weighted average. So residential uses more power, so there were more costs associated with that class. Small general uses less power, so that they saw a smaller increase. But you can modify those rates to get more parity with the increase across your classes. The only reason there's a percentage increase that is different is because more classes have more load, which means higher costs. The more load you have, the more purchase power you
So I kind of look at these as kind of two bookends. You know, here's kind of the easiest and most simplistic implementation of the rate increase. Just kind of apply it equally to all across the board. And then scenario two is kind of the other end of the spectrum, another bookend of, you know, playing with, you know, applying a little bit more, you know, up top and removing the tiered energy rates.
I just thought about it too. The percentage difference is the percent increase in revenues. If you did a percent change in the actual rate, it would be the same for all classes because it's 0.68 added to all classes. But because there's more revenues associated with different classes, the percentage increase could be smaller or larger.
Like Mike was saying on scenario two, every other class except for residential, their increase goes down by about 50%. And it all shifts to residential on the.
And as you point out, we have a large number of residents, and a lot of them are retired.
Sure.
And of course,
sure.
That sometimes might be a little difficult.
Sure.
To sell to the community. I mean, you want to, you know, people are looking for fairness and that sort of thing.
Right.
That might be a little hard to sell.
Yeah.
And I will point out with this scenario, we were just giving an idea as to what it would look like if you modified your rate schedule to remove those tiers. Obviously, you can move the needle on that actual per unit cost. You could reduce residential to make it a smaller increase. We just wanted to give an idea of what it looks like if all classes were under that fixed rate per kWh instead of two classes under a tiered and the rest under a fixed rate. So we're just giving some ideas as to what that would look like.
There's probably a million ways to slice and dice this
in
various scenarios, and I get, you know, kind of bookends, and then it's, well, you know, with feedback and so forth, it's, well, let's, you know, pull this lever a little bit and, you know, go and little bit different direction. So any other questions on the implementation options or overall on the work we did or this area?
Assuming we get a rate increase to 9, this would be good. And if we got a 10, we just bump it up a little bit everywhere. If we got an 8, we lower it slightly. Is that sort of the idea here?
Yeah, I'm sure that as you know, the contract is finalized and you know exactly.
Then we can plug in the exact number.
Right. Yeah. I feel like this is a really good, probably.
Yeah.
You know, fairly confident this is likely.
Yeah.
We're on the target, right? Is it the bullseye? No, because we don't necessarily know what the final contract price is.
I like seeing different options. It's not just going, no, this is what you're going to have to do. Thank you for spending that extra time to do that. It helps us. And is it possible, are we going to be able to get copies of all of this emailed to us?
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's probably one of the more difficult parts of our job is that, you know, I feel like, you know, the job for myself and that of my team is really to, you know, conduct this work in an unbiased way. But certainly we are always going to be one removed and not necessarily in the shoes of the management team and that of the members and that of you all or of directors. And so getting the best information available before you all, getting that feedback, you know, is really the hard part of it. There's things that we can do on paper that look great on a piece of paper, but you roll it out and implement it, it's extremely unpopular. So we want to make sure it's well understood and justified, and then we can always assist with various scenarios to make it the most optically pleasing and acceptable as, you know, as a rate change or a rate increase can be.
I have a question.
Right now, I saw you're estimating about a 75% increase in power costs. If they can negotiate a great deal and we get only a 60% increase, I assume you created a formula and that's where all this plug-in number and it rotates through.
Right.
And at that point, once we have a power contract, forward to that number, have you run it real quick,
yeah,
and give us an updated number for or possible rate increase?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, we don't go anywhere. We're a phone call away, and happy to do that. So, you know, I think as things have, you know, maybe changed over the last months and new information has become available, we've been able to plug in, you know, different things and try to refine it to what, you know, we think it might be today. But we'll see what that contract is.
Could you remind me what was your thought process of putting the margin where you put it?
Sure. So the margin is driven by, you know, for most cooperatives. Now, you all don't have capital credits. So if we think about the cooperative business model, it's a three-legged stool. And the level of margins is to support retiring patronage capital. Take that one off the table. For you all, it's maintaining the level of equity that you all have, you know, currently or today, as well as what is the kind of projected growth in rate base or plant through your construction work plan. And given those two inputs, you know, right now I believe level of equity is 65% or thereabout, and I forget precisely the kind of the growth in rate base that was a couple of percent on average per year, and certainly given some of the projects you all have kind of now and going forward for reliability and resiliency and just normal retirements, the modeling would indicate, you know, kind of here's the suggested level of margins to meet your particular and unique needs. Those would be different for each cooperative. Cooperative isn't growing or retiring plant or adding plant, their level of margins of return would be lower. If their level of equity were something different, their need and level of return and margins would be something different. So those are a couple of the levers that really dictate what's needed from an operating income and margins perspective. Yeah. I think the rate of return here was 5.14%. On average, I always like to kind of put things in perspective. Cooperatives are anywhere between 5 and 7% rate of return on rate base. So you all are within kind of that bandwidth, but given your unique needs, you know, on the lower end of that tier, it's not trust. IOUs probably up in that 9, 10, 11%.
You want the margins higher? We'll talk about that. Jason, thank you. Your team has been wonderful. I have spent the last, I would say, 7 months talking to Nick via Zoom at least twice a month. I'm going to miss you, Nick. And when Jason tells you that there's a million ways to slice and dice this information, Nick has thought through 999,999 of them. He is phenomenal. Jason's team has been wonderful. Omar is wonderful. So thank you for all that you've done for us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Yeah. One thing I'm going to add is when, you know, Jason and Nick have both talked about the variation in prices. As Melissa mentioned, we started working with CFC months ago, and they came, and by the way, they are based in the Washington, D.C. area, so I really appreciate them being here tonight.
Yeah, really.
They came and met with us when we were looking at, you know, prices around the $100, $105 a megawatt hour range, and they produced this model, and since prices have come down, they have reworked that model, so I hope that you guys feel comfortable that they can do that fairly quickly. We've seen a really good product, a quick transition when those things have happened. So really appreciate you guys a ton. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, just answer the phone when you get the 3 a.m. call.
I'm in early risers. Well, 3 a.m. here would be 6 a.m. there.
Yeah, so
I've already been working for 2 hours.
You guys aren't alone. In my previous work, I used to work with the government, now it's Air Force Base being one of them. When you have a fixed contract, 2-3 year contract, 5 years, and you have to renew, the benefit of the contract is you get a fixed price, but then you're subject to market conditions when it renews. Or you could do real-time pricing, which would be insanely scary because prices are going up and down every 15 minutes. So there is a huge benefit to that fixed price contract, but when it renews, then you're susceptible to any changes that occurred over the last 5 years. But from my experience in purchase power and market conditions and the contract I saw you guys signed 5 years ago, like, yeah, you guys definitely made out like bandits. That was a very good contract over 5 years, especially if the last 8 years when some of those prices were well above $100, $120 a megawatt hour. So, I mean, that's just really great strategic planning for sure.
And we didn't pay him to say that, so thank you.
No. I'm just telling you from what I've seen in the past. And obviously, the military is all over. I've worked with all the bases across the country, Army garrisons, and that's a lot of things I saw with renewing those natural gas contracts they had, electric supply contracts. So when I saw this, I'm like, wow. This is a pretty good deal.
Well, thank you. You guys are welcome to stay if you would like, if you have some kind of gluttons for punishment, but you're welcome.
I think we're going to step out, let you all conduct the rest of your business.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you all.
That item was for discussion only, so we will go on to item I, unless does anybody have any other discussion on it right now?
No, we're going to get a copy of that.
Yeah. Okay, item I, review and possible approval of a mutual aid agreement with other Nevada Rural Electric Association participants. That will be for possible action.
So in the Nevada Rural Electric Association, a committee was formed to put together a mutual aid agreement. And we had three of the general managers from three of the NREA organizations that have worked on this for a couple of years. They've looked at agreements that they've had in Utah and Idaho and some of the other western states. Dane Bradfield from Lincoln County led this group. They've presented a product. We've tweaked it a couple of times in our NREA meetings, had Corey and Randall and Kevin go through it and provide comments, and some tweaks were made there in the last go-round. I know that Randall and Corey have worked with you, Byron, and so maybe I'll turn it over to you for a minute to see if you have any additional comments here.
Well, anytime you have an agreement where you have to give aid to other companies, my first concern was, do we have to? Right, are we obligated to? What if we're not in a position to send, or does it put us in a bind if they call for help and we're obligated to go? And so that's the first thing I wanted to look through this and find. And the answer is no, we're not obligated. In fact, they have a very specific clause, number 12, which is discretionary rendering of assistance. Entering into this agreement does not assure any party that aid will be provided if, when, or as requested, nor does it create an obligation for any party to provide assistance. Rendering of aid under this agreement is entirely at the discretion of the assisting party, on a case-by-case basis, based on the resources, challenges, and other circumstances of the assisting party. So, if we were in a situation where we're dealing with our own emergency and they're calling for help, we can say, sorry, we can't. Now, but if we can, of course, and we can provide that aid, we can, and we do. The level of assistance that we provide, again, is up to us. Well, and in conjunction with them, they can also say, yeah, I don't want that help, or I can use this help, but we don't really need that help. And it'll be something that they work out between the agents, between the companies, to determine exactly what OPD, for example, would be providing to Lincoln County or whoever else is in need. And then once you do provide it, then it also has the mechanism of how do we get compensated. So they built into the contract that if we do send employees, equipment, that kind of stuff, the company that sought the aid and receives the aid will be reimbursing us and compensating us for that aid.
How does that reimbursement show?
Both, and they have it worked out for employees, for equipment, for kind of all of
for
it.
For materials.
And it looks like it's more actual costs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of pre-agreed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they will compensate.
And that's where a company might say, okay, that'll be a little expensive for us. We don't want that aid.
Yeah.
But we'll take this aid.
Sure.
If we send employees, another concern was, okay, if we send employees, are they still our employees? No, they remain our employees. Again, we continue to insure, we continue to pay. We'll be reimbursed for that work later. They follow the instructions of OPD in conjunction with our work with them, of course, right? Well, they'll always be a buffer, and if our folk decide, hey, that's too risky, or you're asking us to do something we should not do, they are not obligated to do it.
What's the payback period? We ran into a situation where everybody wanted to wait till the federal government paid, and that took 2 years.
Yeah.
Cost reimbursement, paragraph is 9. I don't remember. Invoicing and payments. Party shall remit payment to the assisting party within 30 days of receipt of an accurate and undisputed invoice.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah. And if there's a dispute, there's a method of how to overcome that dispute. And then once it becomes undisputed or there's an agreed upon amount, then it's within 30 days.
To a couple of the things I also like about this agreement is even though we're all members of NREA, this is not an NREA organization. So there's a committee appointed or elected to be in charge of the mutual aid agreement. If an organization declares an emergency, they have to apply to this committee and get them to approve that it's really an emergency before an emergency declaration is made. So it's just not up to the individual utility to decide if there's an emergency. This committee has to be in consent with that to call out for mutual aid help. The other thing I like is the fact that if we are working and providing aid, we can withdraw at any time too, and bring our people back if we need them. So we're not committed for a fixed time once people are committed.
Do we have any agreements in place now? I know when we had a problem at Tortoise, Dixie sent a truck in, Lincoln came down, and I know we went to Lincoln. And has there been any agreement? Do we have anything through IPSA?
So we have an agreement through IPSA, and we also have some We have some agreements that are formalized with Lincoln County Power District. The things that we do with Dixie and the others have all been informal. And same with Nevada Power. We've looked at doing a mutual aid agreement with them, but where they are a union shop and we're not, there's kind of some difficulties that are complicating factors in that.
So what's the negative about this? What's the drawback?
Taking 4 hours?
I don't know that there's a drawback. Corey, did you have any issues with?
No.
It's very, very well written agreement.
Yeah. I think. How does the staff, like the guys, now they're gone from home for a week, you know, how is that for them? I don't know if you guys have done.
Well, if this was to be enacted, it's an act of mercy as well, right? It's that you're going there to help another neighboring utility.
Does morale seem, like how does it affect morale? I guess that's my question.
Well, I know that when we had the hurricanes down in the Bahamas or Jamaica, I can't remember where it was, and we had some guys that were willing to go work there, but they weren't needed.
I did it years ago for Lincoln County. I went and helped, and there was no formal agreement, and it's one of the highlights of my career.
We have such a good relationship with all of our NREA brothers and sisters that we would want to help them, and they would want to help us. We just now have a formalized agreement that says there's going to be a reimbursable for cost on that, and instead of just a handshake.
It's one of the expectations are set in advance.
And currently, whenever there's a message, we get calls from all of the utilities anyways, offering to help if we need it. So it just formalizes a lot of the terms.
I move that we approve the mutual aid agreement and authorize the GMPO to sign the agreement as presented.
Second.
I have a second.
Jack, second.
If that's okay with a second, I'd say third. Okay. There's been a motion and a second to approve the mutual aid agreement and authorize the GM CEO to sign the agreement as presented. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Good work.
Thank you.
It's a good document.
Okay, public comment? Y'all are quiet. Okay. Any board comments?
Yeah, I have just a little bit of a report on. I went to the conference in San Antonio with several people here, and I took some classes, and one I took was a refresher class on the certified director, the very first one, because I took that 10 years ago or some crazy thing. And they had a couple of interesting things I thought I'd share with you. One is that they suggested, among a number of other things that we're doing, by the way, that board member, hopefully the chair, but other board member, should show up at the safety meeting at least once a year to show the employees that the board, too, cares about the safety and it's an important program. Then they can leave before, they don't have to sit through the whole meeting. But just to say, hey, I came down here because this is so important to us. And I thought that was a very good suggestion.
I think that's an excellent.
And the other is that they suggested that we should hold community meetings once in a while. Sometimes they get a little tough because you get a lot of complaints. But they said it's very important to have your connection with the community. And I know we went through some on the last power station we built in my son's city. But I think it might be good once in a while to try to schedule a town hall meet sort of thing. Lots of communities do that and talk about rates. For instance, here's a perfect example because we're going to have that, plan it out, how we're going to do it, and have a couple of community meetings. One on solar because the people want sort of neutral, because the solar guys, they're knocking on your door regularly. And then finally, energy savings was another one they suggested. So it was very valuable. It sort of refreshes what you learned many years ago and catch up on the things that you don't. But I found many, many of the things that they suggested we are doing. So that's really refreshing.
I think didn't we have a meeting up in Mesquite on the solar?
We've had a number of meetings there on the solar, yes.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
kind of remember going to one and thinking, who are these people?
What is our average residential customer's kilowatt usage?
Usually around 1,200 kilowatt hours. It was kind of interesting because a few years back, almost across the United States, we were seeing a reduction in kilowatt hour usage per home. And we saw that until about the time that COVID hit, and it's just skyrocketing back up, and a lot of it's driven by all of the technology that people have in their houses now, including car charging and all that stuff.
Based off that, so our average bill then is $120,
$130. Yeah, I believe our average is around $120, $150, $120.
Well, then I'm above average.
On every level.
In every way. In every way.
I tell you, my solar panels are not working.
It's hard in the rain. Any other board comments? Okay. Do I hear a motion for the approval of the next board meeting, April 17th, in Mesquite?
I move we approve the next meeting, April 17th, in Mesquite.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
I didn't want
to. Yeah, we should have one in Bunkerville, right, Bob?
Yeah.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for the approval of the next board meeting, April 17th, 3 p.m. in Mesquite. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye, and then any. Okay, and we're going into executive session. Let's take about a 5-10 minute break, and then...
You're going to need a break.
We're going to need a break.
Oh, boy.